afternoon. It's Tuesday, September 16th, 2003. And coming to you live from WGMU and George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict.
You're like day, and I'm like night. What if we could get together?
Over the last 2 years has taught me something, that Arafat isn't the only problem. It's not when he goes, you know, hallelujah. And my God, I have listened to understand what drives a terrorist. What drives somebody to blow himself up. And I understand how that is their act of resistance. And that is their response to Ariel Sharon's tank. That's horrifying for me to understand when just a few short months ago I said, that's wrong and I won't allow that to enter my intellectual psyche. What we are doing as the Israelis or as supporters of Israel in our defense is acceptable, and that act of bus blowing up is wrong. And I am hearing enough to make me humble in what I think is right and wrong. And that is the power of listening to somebody different than you. And I feel very, very humbled by this whole wonderful festival that we've had. And I hope that we come away, each of us here, saying to somebody around our table, I heard you. And that's a start.
And good afternoon and welcome to episode 3 of Conflict, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Today on our program, we have a very special guest with us. His name is Mr. Andy Shalal. And he's a bit of an upcoming legend in the Washington, D.C. area, certainly in the peace community. Mr. Shalal has been a lifelong peace activist and has contributed frequently to local, national, and international causes. His commentary about peace and issues pertaining to the Arab-Israeli conflict, specifically, and Iraq as well, has been heard on National Public Radio, Pacifica Radio, MSNBC, CNN, and numerous other radio outlets. Mr. Shalal was recently awarded the Fairfax County Human Rights Award and the Outstanding Volunteer Award for Fairfax County. He is a recipient of the Jefferson Medal, which is the highest volunteerism award in the United States. Andy has helped coordinate the first Global Arab-Jewish Dialogue on July 20th this year, in which over 140 different dialogue groups participated, spanning 5 continents, 18 countries, and 20 cities in the U.S. alone. Mr. Shalal is also active in arts organization. He is a board member of Imagination Stage, which is an organization dedicated to making arts inclusive and available to all children, regardless of disability. He is a member of the Theater J Committee at the Jewish Community Center in Washington, D.C., and is the co-founder of the Peace Cafe, which is a venue promoting dialogue among Jews and Arabs, and which is the subject of today's show. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sean.
Why don't we just go ahead and get started by, if you could, just share a little with us about what the Peace Cafe is and how you came to start it.
The voice of the gentleman you heard at the beginning of the show, who was speaking about the Peace Cafe, that's Ari Roth. Ari, and who is the artistic director at Theater J, and myself, started the idea of the Peace Cafe. He's the artistic director of Theater J, as I mentioned, and Theater J is the theater in the Jewish Community Center. And Ari is very progressive and would like to deal with issues that are a little bit uncomfortable for the Jewish or the Arab community, for that matter. And he brought a play called Via Dolorosa to the Theater J. And when he read the play, he thought the play needs a little bit of debriefing after someone sees it. It's a complicated play that deals with a very complicated subject of the Arab-Israeli conflict that's been going on for so many years. And it's based on archival information from a trip that David Hare, who is the writer of the play, took by going to Israel and Palestine. Came back with lots of stories to tell. It's a one-man show. It was presented at Theater J, and we decided that in order for us to get the full use out of this play and make it into a real opportunity of dialogue, we need to have some dialogue to happen after the play. And so we set up this little cafe. We called it the Peace Cafe, outside in the lobby of the theater. When people were done seeing the play, they came out. They sat down in groups of about six or seven people in round tables. We had some food. We had food that both Arabs and Jews enjoy, like hummus and things like that. We had pita bread for people to break and share. We had dates and figs and all kinds of wonderful foods from the Middle East. And we also had menus on the table. We called them food for thought, and it was little excerpts from the play. So people had the opportunity to look at the menu and be able to think up of topics that they may have forgotten while watching the play and talk to each other. We started by having each person introduce themselves. Then we broke bread in the tradition of all the Abrahamic religions, passed the bread around, and shared the hummus and other goodies that were on the table. Suddenly, the walls sort of come down, and people are more apt to listen and hear each other and talk. The play acted as a foundation, a sort of a conduit for the dialogue, and it was very, very effective, so much so that we decided to do it every single night after every single showing of the play. And suddenly we were having people come back another night and another night and wow. wanted to be involved more and more. So that's how it started.
And when was that, the first one?
It started about 3.5 years ago.
And when you did that, after that initial play, did you have the idea in mind to continue doing these dialogues?
Well, yes. The uniqueness of the Peace Cafe is the fact that the audience has a shared experience, such as a play. And we thought, well, David Hare's play is a wonderful way to do that because it's a one-man show. In fact, we brought it here to George Mason University also. There was a showing here at George Mason that we had about 400 people come to it. And then we had dialogues afterwards. It was very good as well. But the shared experience is very important for a Peace Cafe type of dialogue because it's hard to put people on the same page mm-hmm. and start a conversation from scratch. And a play was a perfect opportunity to do that because we don't listen to each other. We as Arabs and Jews tend to stay within our own communities, talk to each other about one another. But we never talk, we never sort of have any inter-community dialogues. And the play, like any other performance, basically forces the audience to just be quiet and listen. Hmm. And it's an hour and a half show. There's no talking back. You have to listen. And listening is the beginning to understanding. And so it really does create an opening for conversation that otherwise you wouldn't be able to have just to walk into a cold room and start talking. So the play was one way to do it. So we try to figure out a way that how can we get away from just a play, because a play is limiting. You know, you got to find a stage, you've got to find, you know, an actor, you've got to do all these things. And it could get very costly to constantly be producing plays to do this. So we also use film. We decided to go into film. We did a few films. In mm-hmm. fact, Promises was one film mm-hmm. that was about Arab and Jewish children.
I believe that was featured at the Common Ground Film Festival last year.
Yes. It's been featured in several film festivals. It's an award-winning, Oscar-nominated show or film. We also did the film Gaza Strip that was done by James Longley, which is about the Gaza Strip. We've done films that were, there was a film called Women in Black, about Women in Black and the movement of that organization to dismantle or stop the roadblocks that the Israelis put in front of Palestinians. Lots of different opportunities that way. And now we're working on books. We've started mm-hmm. a Peace Cafe book club where we read narratives from different perspectives.
How often do you meet?
We meet at least once a month, the last Sunday of the month. We meet early in the morning, from 9 to 11 in the morning on Sunday. We have food. Always food is a major part of a peace cafe. You can't have a cafe without food. Then we have the discussions. I generally facilitate them, but they tend to facilitate themselves. And they've been extremely successful. We get more and more people each time. You know, the average attendance to a book club event is anywhere from 20 to 50 people.
Wow.
Which is, for a Sunday morning book club, it's pretty good. We've had peace cafes with as many as I said, here at George Mason University, with hundreds, and we've had as few as just a couple dozen.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to choose Sunday morning?
Well, I own a few restaurants here in Washington, and we wanted to do it in the restaurant because it's easier to have food in the restaurant. No one has to put out their house or do any special organizing for it. It was already there. It's accessible to the metro. It's at DuPont Circle, and it was easy for people to be able to get to it, and just a sort of a ready-made environment. Mm-hmm. So, and Sunday morning, we happen to be closed. We don't open till 11, so it's pre-opening time, and made it very easy to do there.
And who comes to these, or who is able to, who's welcome at these peace cafes?
Well, everyone is welcome. We have Arabs, we have Jews, we have Palestinians, Israelis, different nationalities. We have lots of people that are neither Arabs nor Jews.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, since it's right here in Washington, D.C., and we certainly have many concerned citizens who don't come from either of those heritages, but are nevertheless concerned about the issues, and is their participation welcome?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, oftentimes they do act as the sort of the bridge sometimes to bring us both together. But it's the one thing you hear over and over again about the Peace Cafes, it's a safe place. Mm. It's a place where people feel comfortable speaking what they feel. There's a sense of honesty and a sense of really wanting to listen and really wanting to make a difference that comes through on each side. And many relationships have formed out of the Peace Cafe. We have groups now that have sort of broken off from Peace Cafe.
Really?
And do, for example, lobbying in Congress. Mm-hmm. Or there's an activist group that wants to do activism. For example, some educational programs on the wall that's being erected by Sharon and company to dismantling some of the roadblocks, allowing Palestinians to be able to travel freely. Those types of issues are being discussed now, and lots of teach-ins are happening. And these are Arabs and Jews coming together to create these venues, where before this they would have never thought to work together because there's a lack of trust between both sides, and no one knows what the other one's up to, what their intentions are, and they tend to stay away from each other. But with this kind of a format, they've developed the relationship, and they can move on to do other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and speaking about people who, build bridges or otherwise who are not directly involved with the conflict, certainly outside mediators and negotiators have tried to make a difference in the Middle East, and one of those, I understand, was Ambassador Dennis Ross during the Clinton administration, and I understand he was at that first play and Peace Cafe?
Yeah, he came to one of the Peace Cafes we did early on, and he did contribute to it. He was very thoughtful in his words, we have to say, but the Peace Cafe is not about having a speaker come and speak, per se. It's the people. We believe that people are the ones that can make the difference, individuals. That although that Dennis Ross did come to that Peace Cafe, the format changed from a Peace Cafe to more of a lecture, basically, which is not necessarily why people come to Peace Cafes.
Right.
There are many, many policy forums here in Washington where people sit, everybody shows up at a forum, you have three or four talking heads, they talk about the issues, and they walk away feeling more depressed and more empty than when you walked in. The Peace Cafe allows people to not have to know anything about policies. You don't have to know much about history or numbers or figures or statistics or any of these things. Those are left behind. It's all about personal stories. It's all about personal feelings about the conflict. It's all about emotions. It's all about stories. It's all about narratives. We know for too many times that why every time some figure comes out from one side, the other side is quick to rebuff and come up with their analysis of what that figure means. So it ends up to be just white noise, and it's a wash. Nobody walks away feeling any better or move forward at all, just from hearing numbers and figures and facts, quote unquote.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you do a bit of facilitating yourself at these cafes, and certainly I imagine you have other facilitators who come in to assist. How do you...
I think, like I said, I think it's mostly self-facilitated. Mm-hmm. There's really no real facilitation per se. If there is any facilitation, it certainly doesn't feel like facilitation. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of getting the show started, basically, and then letting people kind of take over from there. Sometimes I'll see the dialogue going in a direction that becomes more combative or more of a debate, and I try to remind people these are not debates. Peace cafes are not debates. This is not you trying to prove your point to the other person and drill it down their head and not walk away till they say yes. This is about just telling your side of the story and the other side to listen and not to agree, not to disagree necessarily, but just to listen. It's easier said than done because the natural tendency is when you hear something that you don't believe in, you want to rebuke it. You want to make sure that the other person doesn't walk away feeling like they have been validated.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with all due respect to the media, it certainly seems like more and more media shows, both talk, radio, as well as television, seem to just love that debate format. And I must admit, it can be entertaining, but you're right. At the end of it, you just kind of walk away and, you know, so what? What have we really accomplished?
Yeah, absolutely. I was, speaking about debate in the media. I was on Fox News. I'd been doing a few shows on Fox News about the Iraq conflict, and they would have me on, and I generally tend to be very polite and, say what I have to say in a polite manner. And I remember going on my way to the show to do this one talk show for Fox News. The producer called me. I was in the car on my way in, called me on my cell phone, and she said to me, she says, "We love having you. You're very thoughtful and everything, but could you be a little more rude?"
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding you. This is a quote.
Oh my gosh.
And I thought, wow. I said, I'll do my best.
Balanced on poops. I can't say that.
I said, I'll do my best. But it's interesting. Yeah, it is about just entertainment and rather than real showing the facts, telling the story. But to tell me, can you be a little more rude? I thought it was told the story right there.
Well, think back to kind of the beginnings of these peace cafes. Did you get a sense from the groups that they really wanted to keep going? You mentioned that there's been some kind of splinter organizations or at least efforts that have come out of this, and those have been just totally spontaneous.
Yeah, I mean when you think of a splinter group, you think of a group that they got sort of pissed off and went off on their own. These are just groups that have sort of built on and piggybacked on the Peace Cafe idea. Mm-hmm. There were people that formed relationships within the Peace Cafe and decided we want to do more, and this is just one way to do it. They still come to Peace Cafe events, but this is just something else. It's a very rejuvenating experience for really most people, I think. It's a respite. It sort of reaffirms the fact that we're all human beings, we all have feelings, we all want the same basic things. Oftentimes that's missed in the debates and in the dialogues that do take place.
Mm-hmm.
There's the idea of telling a story is so powerful. People just walk away feeling moved. People don't get moved by numbers. They don't get moved by figures. They don't get moved by facts. But they do get moved by stories of real people.
What kind of stories do they share?
Everything. I mean, everything from actual experiences that the people have faced. to having relatives that have been killed. We had people that came from the, for example, from the parent circle, which is the bereaved parent circle. They're parents that have lost children in the conflict there.
Mm-hmm.
Israeli parents and Palestinian parents, and they formed an organization called the Bereaved Parent Circle. It goes around telling people that violence is not the answer. This is not the way to bring about peace. We can't go on killing one another's kids. And this organization has been extremely effective because they tell a story, a very moving, moving story. The founder of it, Yitzhak Frankenthal, his kid, Avi, was kidnapped and killed by Palestinians. And his co-founder, a Palestinian who's had two of his brothers shot by Israeli soldiers. And these people decided to put all this behind them and say, let's move on, let's be friends, let's be brothers and sisters like we're supposed to be on this earth. And it's very powerful. It's a very moving, moving experience. When you hear them, you can't help but say, everything else I'm saying is really pretty petty.
Wow. You know, certainly with these dialogues happening right here in Washington, D.C., and the amount of empathy that is established and, mutual understanding, certainly, what do you believe that can lead to in terms of actual efforts? I mean, certainly the degree of conflict, violent conflict, that we hear more and more about every day in the Middle East just seems daunting and unstoppable, seemingly.
Mm.
How do you feel these types of dialogue activities can actually have ultimately an impact on, or is it intended for that, or is it intended for something else?
Well, I've stopped sort of putting sort of goals necessarily to Peace Cafe. I mean, it's very difficult for us sitting here in Washington, our comfortable homes, eating our wonderful food, and sort of just telling the Palestinians and Israelis to just stop it. It just doesn't work that way. The reality is they have to make those moves on their own, and they have to make those decisions. When the pain gets too hard, they'll figure out a way to bring it up to a stop. For us here in Washington, I think we can make a difference in one another. We can make a difference in ourselves. And that's really the key of the Peace Cafe. It's about personal transformation. It's not about changing other people. It's about changing oneself. You got to start somewhere. And you have no power over what anybody else feels or thinks. You do have a power over how you feel, how you think. And this is really, I mean, the stories I hear from people that come to Peace Cafes reaffirms for me the fact that this is worthwhile, because it's making a difference in individuals, individual lives, individual feelings, and that's more than other people can say they've done. So for me, it's been extremely successful in that sense. The violence in the Middle East has gotten worse in the last 3 years than better. When we started the Peace Cafe, the Peace Cafe wasn't intended to end the violence in the Middle East. It was intended to end the violence within each one of us. The way we think about one another, the way we act, the way we do things, the way we go about doing our business, the way we talk about each other behind each other's back. All these things add up to bad karma in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, slowly people will change. People eventually will change.
You mentioned how the Peace Cafe is a safe place for people to go, and it seems apparent that it's not just about hearing other perspectives, but about feeling heard yourself and having a place to be able to share your feelings and your perspectives.
Yeah, I think it is about that as well. I think it's also, I think it allows you to get out of your own story as well. People get trapped in their tales, and unless they hear a different version, their story gets more and more entrenched and less apt to be open for change. And I think when you come to the Peace Cafe and you hear stories from others, it sort of jolts your story a little bit and allows you to think and see things in a different way. And that's really key.
And that's actually a good segue to a clip I'd like to share. I got this from the video Visions of Peace, which chronicles the Peace Cafe. Which, by the way, is that available to folks if they want to get a hold of that?
Or? No, it's actually not. It's okay. Just a proprietary piece of...
Well, if I may, I'm going to go ahead and share a clip that addresses that very need to understand other perspectives. And listeners, please kind of wait to the end. There's a bit of a surprise, so you may not be hearing what you think you're hearing.
I truly believe that refugees, and you know, I try to understand that they're suffering and all that stuff, but I really don't think it's logical for them to even try and go back into Israel, because first of all, Israel is the land for Jewish people, and second of all, it's just very hard for us to accommodate about 4 million of you guys, and you know, the refugees are only a consequence of Arab aggression, and therefore I believe that the Palestinians are the only people that are supposed to entitle themselves to solve this problem in whatever pieces of land that are given.
How can you say such a thing? I mean, my grandma still walks around with a key in her hand to her own home. So why shouldn't she be able to go back to her home?
It's because, I mean, I just told you, we're not able to accommodate 4 million of those refugees. We're hardly able to, you know, support our own people. And therefore, I believe that you should work hard to change the conditions in refugee camps to a little better place. Why should I, the person who works all the time and gains my own money, give anything to you?
Well, we don't have the opportunity to work. How are we supposed to work when you impose checkpoints everywhere? We're not even allowed to move in our own place.
The only reason we have checkpoints is because of your terrorists. That's why, you know, we have to ID everyone. Yeah.
What about your terror? What about your occupational army that humiliates us?
The only reason we're occupying your country is because your government is not able to control anything, and that's why we need to control it for you.
Well, how can our government control anything, though? You basically force these organizations to come in. They wouldn't exist if your army wasn't in our land.
Our army is protecting you guys from your own evilness because, I mean, look at that. Al-Jihad people are promising to kill Arafat. I mean, if we weren't there, they would have gotten him a long time ago. So you should be thankful to us.
Why should we be thankful for you? I mean, you came and took our place. You kicked us out.
There was nobody in Palestine when we came in. It was a desert, and we created all those cities, and then when we created them, you guys wanted something.
It's ludicrous. I mean, we were there, and you came, and you started the Zionist movement, and then, you know, you said that this is your land, and you kicked us out. So, I mean, even your leader now, he's a terrorist himself.
Our leader is a terrorist?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Your leader's a terrorist. He killed 1,000 people in Sabra and Zatila. So, I mean, how are you supposed to think he's a democratic official?
But, I mean, the only reason he got... Well, now he's my prime minister. I think I should give him all my support. At least he's trying his best to fix things.
His best? He's...
Which side?
I truly believe that Sharon is a terrorist. I mean, look at that.
So that was a bit misleading, perhaps. You mentioned that peace cafes are not about debate, and what we certainly heard there was a debate, but yeah. Then all of a sudden somebody said, switch sides. What was that all about?
These are two kids from Seeds of Peace, the organization that brings Palestinian and Israeli children here in Maine to learn how to coexist with one another. These were two graduates of Seeds of Peace. They're both, I think, 18 years old. One was a Palestinian, one was an Israeli. And sometimes we do some dramatizations for the Peace Cafe. This was one of them. This was a dramatization between the Israeli kid and the Palestinian kid. And the point that was trying to be made in this exercise is how both sides are the flip side of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of us is sort of the opposite of the other. For each action of one side, there's a reaction on the other side. The Palestinian kid was actually taking on the Israeli role in this little clip that you just played. And the Israeli kid was taking on the Palestinian role. And then the director of Seeds of Peace, Bobby Gottschalk, said switch sides. And in the middle of the sentence, they suddenly take each other's side all of a sudden. And they're both able to tell the story of the other so well that they can debate the Israeli side or the Palestinian side at the drop of a hat. So it shows you how the two sides are so intertwined with one another. The conflict is just so much an integral part of each other's psyche and narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine through these dialogues that people must come to amazing degrees of understanding of the other side, and perhaps, presumably, feel like they want to do something about it, other than just have the place to talk. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's the most difficult thing, is people want to see results. They want to know tangible results. What are we doing to make a difference? Because we're not just here to just talk nice to each other. We're mm-hmm. here to want to make a difference. I don't have the answer for that. I just, you know, people have to figure that out for themselves. Some people, like I said, have started their own organization. Mm-hmm. There's a group that started from the Peace Cafe that does lobbying on the Hill. Arabs and Jews together go side by side mm-hmm. and visit members of Congress, telling them that we both want this to stop and we both want X, Y, Z. And there are groups that have started other organizations that want to do some teach-ins on different topics, sort of debunking the myths that oftentimes the media mm-hmm. feeds us in this conflict.
In fact, in a few weeks, we're going to have Dr. Amer Abdullah on the show, and he's mm. going to be discussing a project that he's working on, in fact, called Project Light. Mm. And I'm still learning a little bit more about it, and we'll find out. I believe he's going to be on September 30th, in just 2 weeks. And so tune in and hear some efforts that are being done there. You know, to get back to the Peace Cafe, I mean, you've really just taken this and run with it. It sounds like it pretty much has a life of its own.
It does. People look forward to it. I mean, we have now a email list of over 600 people. In fact, before I came here, it was 624. Mm-hmm. All of them active members of the Peace Cafe. There's no membership per se, really, mm-hmm. but they're have chosen to be on that list and want to continue to be on that list. They receive information about upcoming Peace Cafes. The list is very tightly protected. It's not given out to anyone. Mm-hmm. And it only sends out information about upcoming Peace Cafe events. It does not... I don't do policy analysis. Mm-hmm. I don't put out papers. I don't do clips from newspaper articles, things like that.
So, you know, when you see that in your inbox, you know it's only about Peace Cafe.
It's only about Peace Cafe events that are coming up.
Where could someone go to if they wanted to join that list? Is that possible?
Yeah, we do have a website that we started. Peacecafe.net is the website. Actually, it was put together to us by a GMU student.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, fantastic.
And did a very fine job. When we did the Global Day of Dialogue, Arab-Jewish mm-hmm. Dialogue, we decided we want to do it through the web because that was the cheapest and easiest way for us to get the word out. And we did it through that, and we've received a tremendous amount of feedback through that website.
And that is peacecafe.net.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go ahead and take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you a little more about that Global Day of Dialogue and find out what occurred there. And we're back here with Conflict on WGMU, coming from Fairfax, Virginia, George Mason University. And our guest today is Andy Shalal, and he is the co-founder of the Peace Cafe, which aims to provide a safe place for dialogue and building of mutual understanding among Jews and Arabs. Andy, I understand recently that you were involved in actually kind of putting on a major event entitled Global Day of Dialogue?
Yeah, it's the first Global Day of Arab-Jewish Dialogue. And we wanted to expand the circle of dialogue so that we can get more people to the table to talk, because we do believe that there's power in speaking to one another, looking at each other face-to-face and speaking. I know that in this day and age with the Internet, we tend to do lots of our dialoguing via email and mm-hmm. on the Internet. And one word of caution, it doesn't work. it's a very, very unsafe format.
Why is that?
Well, we tried it at some point a while back. We were doing some dialogue through. I started a sort of a informal living room dialogue group
mm-hmm.
where several Arabs and Jews here in Northern Virginia decided to get together and talk. This is a few years ago. And we started, we had wonderful meals together, we had wonderful conversations, and then everyone went home, and they started, you know, going to the email and sort of remembering where they left off, and then picking up from there, adding to it some embellishment, including clips and pictures and photographs and quotes, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly there was a need to continue to escalate the level of facts you sent to the other person, and pretty soon it went out of hand, and people started to have the need to try to undo what the other person had done in order for them to prove their point. And it really drew us further and further apart rather than brought us closer together.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing that I've found that can substitute face-to-face dialogue.
What kind of challenges do you face conducting these dialogues?
I think some people are impatient. They want to see change immediately. They want to have the other side hear them, acknowledge what they have said, and you know, some people come with a different expectation. I've learned at the beginning of every Peace Cafe to tell people to lower their expectations. They probably walk away more frustrated than when they came in.
Mm-hmm.
For them not to feel like they want to put a sort of a nice bow at the end of the conversation, walk away feeling now the other person can see what I have to say. This doesn't usually happen. In fact, rarely does it ever happen. And people have to look inside. They can't keep looking out for answers. They have to look within, because the answers are inside each one of us. And if we want to make a difference, if we want to move, we can. If we want the other person to move, who knows? Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Very slight chance.
Let's think about this Peace Cafe. It's not really a place. It's not really a concept per se. It's a process, and it's a process of dialogue and a narrative process. Could we talk a little bit more about that?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I think we do each come because we have so much baggage. You know, Arabs and Jews grow up with this issue. You know, most of us have lived all of our lives in the Arab-Israeli conflict. It colors everything we do, Arabs and Jews. And so the story is so deep and so entrenched, so well protected. It's very difficult to break it apart. In fact, almost impossible, particularly when you go back to your own community. It's one thing when you're sitting in a mixed community of Arabs and Jews and you can sort of have an exchange. Once you go back to your own community, if you want to share some of that exchange with them, they look at you like you've lost your mind, that you're a traitor, mm-hmm. almost. You know, you have to hold on to that story. You can't let it go. And so the Peace Cafe tends to break apart that story because you start hearing alternative mm-hmm. viewpoints and contradictory stories, and you think, huh, those two can't fit on the same page. They've got to be some give and take here.
In the academic world, I guess they call that cognitive dissonance.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So with that, you start to think differently because you have to adjust your thinking in order for you to make sense out of what you're hearing. And I think slowly there is some shifting in the story. It's very difficult, though, once you shift that story to be accepted mm-hmm. back into your own community.
Which is clearly a major challenge in the Middle East for those
yes.
who do accept or at least make attempts to understand the other side. How do they then face those around them?
Yeah.
I can't imagine you have any magical answers, but do you have any advice for how people can go away from a process or an experience which teaches them something different than they had once thought? And how could they then go back to those, their peers whom they respect as well, but who have different perspectives and don't necessarily have or did not have the same experience to be able to understand how, you know, your experience has or your perspective has changed. So, in other words, I go to a Peace Cafe and I have my, you know, my common held beliefs about, you know, Israelis, Palestinians, you know, whose fault it is, whatnot. And I know my friends share those views as well, and all of a sudden I'm transformed at this event, and I meet people and I hear I hear perspectives that I never could have conceived of before, and it really changes me. Now I go back, and I'm hanging out with my friends, and they're complaining about, you know, one side or the other, and what advice do you have for me? What can I do in that situation?
Well, I think, you know, you have to turn the story around toward them and ask the questions. You know, I think there's something in conflict resolution also called appreciative inquiry, and sometimes mm-hmm. you can poke holes in a story through that. You know, you ask questions and sort of let the person's cognitive process take sort of a different avenue. Eventually, you know, people start seeing that their story isn't really holding up as tightly as they think it does. It's not an easy thing, but the more Arabs and Jews you have interacting with one another, the more likely they are to be able to break up each other's tales. And the truth lies somewhere in the middle, probably. The important thing is not to continue with that sort of inbred narrative that we all get stuck into, where the story, you know, sort of takes a life of its own and starts to weave down this abyss, mm-hmm. and it can't come out of it. You know, you got to air it out. You got to let the sun in. You got to bring in new ways of seeing things, poke holes in it, you know, and see if it holds up. And chances are it won't. And the more interactions you have, the more likely it will be that the story will not take hold. But again, it's easier said than done. It's mm-hmm. very difficult to have you go back to your own community and try to convince them mm-hmm. of what you just heard. The best way to do is go back to your community and invite them into a peace cafe. Tell them to come. Just try it. And I've done that. I've done that where we have people that say, oh, this doesn't work, I don't trust this, I don't trust that, I don't believe that they ever listen, I don't believe they ever hear you, blah, blah, blah. You bring them in, and, you know, they may not feel totally different, but they do feel that this is a great opportunity. They do see a value. Mm-hmm. And they're not sure what it is, but this comes across as having a valuable tool.
Again, if to get more information about peace cafes, if you want to join one, learn more about it, or dialogue in general, go to peacecafe.net. And Andy, I understand you're now working on kind of book themes with the peace cafes. What's upcoming?
Well, books were obviously, there's lots of books on the subject, lots and lots of different books on the subject. We wanted to sort of go and read a history book, for example, on the topic, because history is oftentimes a big issue in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Whose history are we telling? What really happened in 1948? Why does one group, you know, call it al-Nakba, and the other group, you know, celebrates it every year as the Day of Independence? So those types of things, we wanted to be able to have some shared experience, and a book was an opportunity for that. We did find a book that has probably as much balance as any book has on the subject, although still not very balanced. A book by David Shipler mm-hmm. called Arab and Jew.
Mm-hmm.
The book takes you through, you know, the beginning and brings you all the way to the present time. It's a pretty thick book with many different chapters. And what we did is we did peace cafes one chapter at a time. So we took one chapter a month and we read it. People came back with their notes, their dog ears and their, you know, markings and so on, and we discussed it point by point. We invited the author to come for the first one and gave us kind of an overview of what he wrote. And then we invited the author at the last 8 months later. We did it. We did this 8 month book club. 8 months later, to come and sort of share. Mm-hmm. We were now educating him basically about some of the things that we discovered that maybe were inaccurate or we thought they were skewed to one side or the other. was extremely thankful to have us do that. I mean,
mm-hmm. What type of things do you think he learned from that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we here in the United States tend to have the Jewish perspective clearly in our radar. We don't see much of the Arab perspective or the Palestinian perspective. And I think there's many assumptions that are made that really would be changed if you see the other side. David Shipler is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was the bureau chief for the New York Times in the 80s in Jerusalem. So, you know, he even himself said, he says, you know, reporters are somewhat lazy and they want the story the easiest way they can get it. And especially in that area, it's very difficult for a reporter to find a story. Because if they want to find the Arab story, they have to go into an Arab village or an Arab town, which means checkpoints along the way, mm-hmm. which means it may take them hours to get there. They have to do the research and find the right people and talk to them and learn the language and so on and so forth. Then they have to head home. And they may or may not make it in time because the roadblocks, checkpoints, or problems may occur on the way. So it's much easier to be sitting in Jerusalem and getting your stories from the IDF. What happened? A kid got shot because he happened to be in the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the story you write. There's no real humanity behind it. There's no story behind that kid. What was the kid doing? How did he get in the way? What do you mean he was in the way? None of these things are addressed or talked about.
And these are the stories, I presume, that are spoken at these peace cafes.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the things that make the difference. These aren't just some kid that happened to be in the way. This is someone's child.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone's grandson. This is a kid that could have grown to be somebody very unique and very special. Poof, gone. You know, we take these things so lightly. Oftentimes, I think I've heard Arabs say, for example, from the Jewish perspective, if a Jewish child gets killed, we hear the whole story of the Jewish child, as we should hear about every child that mm-hmm. gets killed. But if you look at the numbers of how many Jewish children have died, how many Arab children has died, it's like 1 to 20. 20 Palestinian kids to 1 Israeli kid. Yet you don't see those types mm-hmm. of numbers and those types of stories being talked about.
Wow. Really leaves you wondering about the kind of information we get. And I guess all information to some extent is somewhat biased. It's a matter of, can you get both perspectives? And the Peace Cafe certainly seems like a place to get those perspectives.
Yeah, we really don't get lots of like I said, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this is not about just facts or quotes or the latest, you know, figures that are coming from there or here. This is really about personal stuff. We had one time at a Peace Cafe, somebody, you know, was saying there's no Palestinians, you know, the Palestine did not exist, and so on and so forth. You know, some myths that were being bandied around, and some guy came and he had the key to the house that his grandmother has held for years, and hanging in the front door of their home in Ramallah, and they had moved over here and they brought the key with them. This, the key symbolizes the return back to their original home in Haifa. So very, very moving, very powerful,
mm-hmm.
very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
We've been reading a book by a Palestinian author by the name of Fawaz Turki, who left in 1948 from Haifa, went to Ramallah after the Al-Nakba, or the War of Independence, as the Israelis call it. And he tells an extremely powerful personal story about his uprooting and his family's uprooting, and how now he's not accepted anywhere. He's not a citizen of any country. He's an American. He actually moved to Australia, became an Australian citizen, and then moved to the United States and became a United States citizen. He's still a Palestinian. And no matter where he goes, he's always going to be a Palestinian. And it's very interesting, because for Palestinians, there's a guilt. The ones that left in 1948, there's a guilt because they left, you never to return. That stays in the minds forever and ever. In fact, it's in the Arab psyche in general. I remember I'm from Iraq, and I have many relatives that live in Baghdad, even now. And right before the outbreak of the war, this last war in Iraq, we were talking to some of our relatives in Baghdad, and I remember my mother telling my uncle, just get in the car and leave. This is before the first bomb started falling. And my uncle said, no, we don't want to be like the Palestinians. We don't want to leave our homes, never to return. It's deeply embedded in the Arab psyche, the Palestinian problem.
With that said, what do you believe we can learn immediately about the ongoing issues in the Middle East, particularly Palestinian-Israeli? What can we learn from that in terms of what, well, pretty much solely the United States government is working towards presumably creating in Iraq?
Well, I think we really have the, as we move forward, we see how important the Arab-Israeli conflict is to every conflict in the Middle East. It colors everything. And how we deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict is a reflection of how we are perceived by other Arab countries. The injustice that seems to be ongoing, the sort of the one-sidedness that's oftentimes taken in this conflict, is reflective of how the United States is perceived by other Arab countries. Arab countries and the Arab public on the street doesn't have faith or trust in the United States. As we are sitting here speaking, they're holding Iran to a standard about the IAEA, the Atomic Energy Organization, the UN Atomic Energy IAEA, International Atomic Energy Association, something, agency, I think. And they have given them a deadline of October 31st to go in and inspect their nuclear power plants to make sure that they're not producing nuclear weapons. Well, Israel has the most number of nuclear weapons in that region. They've never been inspected. The UN has never put any pressure on them at all.
So it seems like a bit of a double standard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's seen as a double standard. Iran is not an Arab country, but nonetheless, it's part of the Middle East. And, you know, it's painted as evil, whereas Iraq, you know, was invaded because of these types of things, and we haven't found any weapons of mass destruction, as we know. And yet Israel tends to be held to a whole different standard. And they're an occupying force. I mean, they've been occupying Palestinian land for, you know, almost 40 years. And still, the issue is moot. Nobody wants to talk about it. Resolution after resolution I put forth to tell Israel to stop it. And yet, it doesn't seem to matter much, and we don't hold Israel to a standard, the same standard that we hold, for example, we held Iraq to, or any other country for that matter.
Well, there certainly is no shortage of, there are no shortages of issues to discuss. And with that said, we're quickly running out of time. We're going to go to a short commercial break, come back with a few announcements and some closing remarks. And we're wrapping up our program of conflict today on WGMU, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And next week on Conflict, from Navy SEAL to cooperative problem-solving expert, we'll hear from Tom Dunn of Montgomery County, Maryland. Not only will you hear some fascinating stories about Mr. Dunn's remarkable life, you are sure to glean some first-hand knowledge of what cooperative problem-solving is all about. Well, Andy Shalal, thank you so much for coming on the program today. We're just wrapping it up and out of time. Really want to thank you for sharing your Peace Cafe program with us. And again, for those of you interested in finding out more about it or perhaps joining a Peace Cafe in Washington, D.C., the address to go to is peacecafe.net.
Thank you very much, Sean.